Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 589, Interview with Lucy Commissar about the BCCI. This has been recorded on March 11th of the year 2007. And once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves investigative journalist Lucy Commissar, who has authored a chapter in a forthcoming book about the BCCI. Lucy, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, before we talk about how the BCCI relates both to Saddam Hussein, the late Saddam Hussein, and Iraq, and also Iran. Tell us what the book is, who published it, and maybe encapsulate some of the other stuff in the book, as you did in Side 1, and tell us how people can get it.
Okay, the book is called A Game as Old as Empire. It's a follow-on to Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which was written by John Perkins. This book is edited by Stephen Hyatt. It is published by Barrett Kohler. And it has a series of perhaps a dozen chapters, which in my case deal with BCCI. It's called BCCI's Double Game, Banking on America, Banking on Jihad. But other chapters include the mirage of debt relief, global uprising, the web of resistance, the Philippines, the World Bank, and the race to the bottom, selling money in dependency, setting the debt trap. So it is looking at the world and how the people who have economic power have spread their tentacles to take a lot of the assets that by rights ought to belong to the people in the countries that live where they exist and have been guilty of a good deal of exploitation, of weapon selling, of hyping debt that goes to dictators who steal the money and leave the people holding the bill because they've got to pay it back. So it's a very wide-ranging, interesting book. You can get it on my website at a big one-third discount. The website is thecommissarscoop.com, and commissar is spelled K-O-M-I-S-A-R. The Commissar Scoop is one word, .com. And if you look on the homepage, you'll see a link to Amazon where you can get the book at a nice discount. The official publication date is March 19th.
And it's published by Barrett Kohler, a small publisher based right here in the Bay Area in San Francisco. Lucy, we've been talking about the BCCI and the many, many intersections of their operations. The BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International, as current Secretary of Defense and former CIA Director Robert Gates called it, went down in the early 1990s. It collapsed, but it operated in many different spheres, and the waves that have spread out from its collapse are still and its operations are still very much with us today. A lot of headlines, scary headlines, bloody headlines, heart-wrenching headlines about the goings-on in Iraq and Iran, and both of those were two of the areas in which BCCI figured prominently. Saddam Hussein and Iraq and the BCCI. Tell us about that.
Well, let's start with Saddam Hussein. The BCCI, and with the help of Washington friends, funneled millions of dollars to the Atlanta Bank of the Italian government-owned Banca Nazionale del Lavoro. That was Baghdad's American banker. So that from 1985 to 89, it could make $4 billion in secret loans to Iraq to help it buy arms. So let's go through this again. BCCI was moving $4 billion through the Atlanta branch of Banca Nazionale del Lavoro, which was owned by the Italian government. This was Baghdad's American banker, an arms financer. Congressman Henry Gonzalez had a hearing on BNL, Banca Nazionale del Lavoro, in 1992, and he quoted from a confidential CIA document that said the agency had long been aware that the bank's headquarters was involved in the American branch's Iraqi loans. The U.S. tried to say that this was a rogue bank, but it wasn't. There were kickbacks from 15% commissions on BNL-sponsored loans channeled into bank accounts held for Iraqi dealers via BCCI offices in the Cayman Islands, as well as in offshore Luxembourg and Switzerland. BNL, Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, was a client of Kissinger Associates, and Kissinger was on the bank's international advisory board, along with Brent Scowcroft, who had become George Bush Sr.'s national security advisor. So when the Bush administration now gets very indignant at oil for food payoffs, that's a little bit disingenuous. There are kickbacks going on when Bush 1 was in power, done via a bank on whose international advisory board Kissinger and Scowcroft sat. And Bush and his friends knew that Saddam was making payoffs because their favorite criminal bank was moving the money.
And once again, something that I commented on in Side 1, we once again see the BCCI linked with yet another scandal-tainted bank, the BNL, the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, part of what I, again, in the 80s was calling the Mediterranean merry-go-round. And so when we see when we saw, because they're in the past now, but when we saw the discussions of what a threat Saddam Hussein represented, leaving aside the dissembling that took place, the fact of the matter is that not only the arming of Saddam Hussein, but a lot of his weapons of mass destruction that he had in the 1980s, such as the chemical weapons he used against the Iranians and against his own people, came from this milieu, and we, or at least powerful people in America, were helping to further that cause. Lucy, on the other side of that, of the 1980s Iran-Iraq war, of course, was Iran. We're seeing a lot of discussion, obviously, about Iran's nascent nuclear capability. And one of the things that, although in this country I think the debate has been pretty bankrupt on both sides, in the international press there's been a fair amount of discussion by Iranians and others knowledgeable about the situation that, in fact, it was the Iran-Iraq war and specifically Saddam Hussein's unbridled use of weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons and biological weapons in particular, against the Iranians that led them to say, the Iranians to say, never again. Basically, we are never going to be on the receiving end of something like this. Again, we are going to have a deterrent if anybody wants to do this again. The Iran-Iraq war also saw the arming of Iran through this same BCCI. Tell us about the Gokhale firm and how that was used for the arming of Iran.
A Pakistani arms dealer named Arif Durrani said that during the Reagan and Bush administrations, the CIA used BCCI to finance shipments of Hawk missiles to Iran to promote a stalemate in the Iran-Iraq war. And BCCI's largest borrower at that time was the Gulf Group. It was the family company of Mustafa Gokhale, who was financial advisor to Ayatollah Khomeini. BCCI gave the Gulf Group unsecured loans of $800 million, more than two-thirds of its total capital, and the Gokhale Group provided Iran with war material, food, and drugs. So here we have BCCI arming both sides, but of course, that's what some of the Americans running our country wanted. They wanted that stalemate.
In a parenthetical note, Arif Durrani was recently extradited to the United States from Mexico, or perhaps indicted. I believe he was physically extradited for helping to run weapons to the al-Qaeda milieu as well. So he has stayed in business. Lucy, when examining BCCI, one of the things that looms large are the many profound connections to Saudi Arabia. We have touched on these. I wonder if you would perhaps review and or expand on those. In particular, focusing on Khalid bin Mahfouz, a very powerful man, yet a name largely unknown to most Americans.
The family of Khalid bin Mahfouz owned the National Commercial Bank, the largest bank in Saudi Arabia, the banker to King Fahd and other members of the ruling family. They bought 20 to 30% of the BCCI stock for nearly $1 billion, and Khalid was put on the board of directors. The family also got $176 million in loans from BCCI. But as true for the other loans from the Arab backers, they were written off the books or they were paid on paper by moving money among offshore banks. So it made BCCI in many ways a big Ponzi scheme. Bin Mahfouz was one of the people that was targeted by District Attorney Robert Morgenthau when he went after BCCI, because Bin Mahfouz was a very large shareholder. The U.S. government pulled back as much as they could from going after BCCI and was forced to only because Morgenthau was out in front of them, and it was becoming very embarrassing. But they did not. They did not go after Bin Mahfouz. He was not indicted. He had to make a deal with Morgenthau. Of course, he was not in the country. There was no way he was going to come back and stand trial. But he did pay some millions of dollars. But the billions of dollars that represented the what was lost when BCCI collapsed, nobody ever found that. So we don't know what role that had in the ability of Bin Mahfouz then to go on and become a very big financier of some of the so-called charities that were really the Islamic fundamentalist groups.
Yeah, a lot of these charities, too, it's a complicated situation for people to wrap around because they do, many of them actually do charitable work and quite good work, but they also, they're Janus-faced, and they also fund the worst terrorists going, including Osama bin Laden, which makes it a very difficult thing for law enforcement because they have to deal with the very sincere outrage of people who know only the charitable face and who are not familiar with the dark, sinister face that lurks behind that. One of the things you talk about, too, in your chapter, Lucy, is the Bin Mahfouz National Commercial Bank link with something called the Intermaritime Bank. I wonder if you'd briefly encapsulate that for us, because that also touches on the links between big Saudi capital, the Bin Mahfouz economic empire, and the residuous, so to speak, of BCCI and al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden.
Well, again, here we get to the spider web. The manager of BCCI's Banque de Commerce et Placement, Geneva Bank, was Alfred Hartman, Banque de Commerce et Placement. But he was also vice chairman of the Bank of New York Intermaritime Bank, also in Geneva. The Intermaritime Bank was connected to the Bank of New York, Boney, the famous Boney of the big Russian money laundering scandal. And he therefore brings in now yet another bank to this very, very murky world. The Intermaritime really becomes another whole story, because they have been involved in a lot of connections to the Clearstream story and to Russian funny money going on. That's another whole program, probably.
Yeah, and in fact, we talked about Clearstream and Mr. Khodorkovsky and some of the mountain of corruption that has erupted after the former Soviet Union, and that very much overlaps a lot of things in this country as well. Lucy, a couple of things. Let's review this. We touched on this in side one, but the current seated president, George W. Bush, is not at all separate from the BCCI milieu. We did talk about it in side one. Let's review it briefly by way of underscoring that this isn't something that's long ago and far away.
No, the BCCI has been very good to the current Bush's business interests. It financed in 1979 and 80, it helped finance his oil company, which was called Arbusto Energy. The money came through a man named Bass, who was in business, and one might think he was moving the money of Mr. Bin Mahfouz. And that money turned out to be very useful for George Bush. When Harkin Energy, which absorbed Arbusto, got into trouble, money trouble, in 1987, it got $25 million in financing from the Union Bank of Switzerland, and as part of that deal, a seat on the board was given to a Harkin shareholder, Sheikh Abdullah Taha Baksh, whose chief banker was a BCCI shareholder, Bin Mahfouz.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get again the money connection. The money comes from CIA. It goes through BCCI in accounts that nobody knows about, that nobody can follow. And then money from the big shareholders of BCCI comes back to George Bush. Isn't that an interesting circle?
It is indeed. It is indeed. An awful lot of these people, in interest are sort of incestuous. Something that came to mind is that Mr. Bakch, as of a few years ago, was heading up a Halliburton oil subsidiary in the Middle East. So these people who are well-connected with this milieu and with the big oil companies and related firms, they just sort of jump from one nest to another and they continue their operations. Inside One, Lucy, we talked about the first George Bush and the links of his milieu to the BCCI. Specifically, the BCCI case broke when the elder George Bush was in power. How did his administration react?
They tried to put the lid on it. BCCI is, as in many similar cases, people that run crooked operations are pretty good at being crooks, but when it comes to honest investing, they don't have much talent. So when the BCCI people took the money that had been deposited in their bank and sought to invest it to make money, they failed royally. They needed to cover up. So because they had offshore accounts, they were able to cook the books for a while. But in the end, when you have a Ponzi scheme, it tends to collapse. There was word percolating out about some of what BCCI was doing. There was a drug money bust in Tampa, Florida, and that involved BCCI. This was an investigation by U.S. government officials, by Justice Department and other investigators connected to the Justice Department. But they, at the same time, Senator Kerry's committee was running an investigation headed by a guy named Jack Blum, who has become something of a hero in BCCI story. They discovered through sources that Noriega was connected to BCCI, and some of this drug money seemed to be connected to Panama. They wanted to expand the investigation. The Justice Department did not want to do it. All they wanted to do was catch a couple of Pakistanis that they said were running drug money and nothing more. So Blum took his information to District Attorney Robert Morgenthau in New York, the District Attorney of Manhattan. He went after the case and began finding out very, very interesting things. Noriega, of course, was then on the CIA payroll. And as the story began to expand, and it involved the fact that BCCI and its Arab owners and shareholders were secretly buying an American bank, which is against the law. You can't do that. It was fronted by Clark Clifford, and as this all began to come out from under the rocks, the U.S. Justice Department tried to stop the investigations. Kerry was going on with his investigations. The CIA lied to him. Morgenthau was going on with his investigations. The Justice Department refused to cooperate. There were tapes that had made showing the link between this bank, the First American Bank, and BCCI, payments to American officials. Those tapes disappeared, according to Jack Blum, Kerry's investigator. He said to me, "There's no question in my mind that it's a calculated effort inside the federal government to limit the investigation. The only issue is whether it's a result of high-level corruption or if it's designated to hide illegal government activities." And
perhaps he might have added both.
Yes, yes. But up until the end, Charles Schumer, now senator, then was a member of Congress, issued a report. After an investigation, he said that Customs had been tipped off to BCI's criminality in 1983, almost a decade before the bank collapsed, by a Jordanian arms dealer and coffee smuggler. He said that in 84, the IRS was told about BCCI money laundering by the former chauffeur at BCCI Miami, but the request by these agents, the IRS agents, to investigate the bank was turned down by their superiors. And one thing after another, a drug enforcement agent tapped a BCCI official in a sting, telling how he could launder his money. No further investigation. The Schumer report found there were hundreds of tips on BCCI to federal agencies, and they ignored them because, of course, this was the CIA's bank.
and a lot of other people's bank as well, including some of the Saudi high rollers who were already at this point, and even more so now, main players on the American financial and corporate scene. Lucy, who was it specifically that headed up the official, who was the U.S. attorney who headed up the BCCI, quote, investigation, unquote, during Bush 1?
Well, if you want to say the person who would be the head of the Justice Department, I think it was Thornburg at a certain point, and there were two of them.
Well, Thornburg was Attorney General, but the guy, the U.S. attorney in charge of the BCCI case was Robert Mueller, currently headed...
Right.
Mueller, who is now head of the FBI, was the U.S. attorney in charge of the BCCI investigation, and his number two attorney at that time, someone who also was helping with this, was none other than Rudy Giuliani. The point being that now, of course, Giuliani is running for president on the Republican ticket, or just vying for the Republican nomination, I should say, and Robert Mueller is currently head of the FBI. I would add parenthetically, Lucy, and we'll move on to more of your chapter material, but when Robert Mueller was appointed head of the FBI, I speculated, in part this was to keep the lid on the can of worms around BCCI, which, if it ever began to emerge, would make it clear to people that George Bush II, the younger George Bush, the current seated president, was in fact part of a business milieu which also involved Osama bin Laden and his family. And also people in Customs and Treasury have been charging that the FBI has actually helped to cover up some of the Al-Qaeda money trail, which ultimately also overlaps BCCI. Lucy, we've been talking about a lot of money, money that's moved for criminals, money that's used to buy weapons, money that was moved by the United States government, money that was moved by the Saudis, by the Pakistani government. An awful lot of that money went missing. What happened to it?
We don't know. It went to some offshore accounts. We don't know what happened to it. Money is fungible. Maybe it went to some of the donations that Bin Masoud made to groups that have now been linked with Osama bin Laden. So the whole point about offshore is it's very hard to follow the money. It wasn't found. And one interesting point was that there were records in a number of warehouses in London. And when the whole story finally broke and when most of the principals all disappeared to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan so they could not be forced to answer for what they had done, there were seven fires in the fireproof London warehouse where BCCI stored its records. In one of them, four firemen were killed.
So the building in which, the London building in which the records were stored was fireproof, and there were seven fires?
There were seven fires.
Well, I don't think one need be paranoid or a, quote, conspiracy theorist, unquote, to see that obviously that indicates wrongdoing and an attempt at covering up the trail. I mean, obviously. I mean, if seven fires in a fireproof building, come on, not even Alberto Gonzalez would buy that, the current attorney general. Editorialization, but what the heck. Lucy, we've got about 5 minutes left in the broadcast. We've been covering an awful lot of unsavory activities and things that obviously involve some very powerful institutions and very powerful people. What lessons do you think are to be drawn from this for American policy, perhaps for the foreign policy of other for the policies of other countries?
One thing is that the things that happen, such as illegal arms trafficking, support of terrorists, these things require financial systems. You can't do it without being able to move money, and they can be done. The illicit movement of money can be done because there exists an offshore banking system, an international bank secrecy, corporate secrecy system. And until we target that, until we do away with the secrecy, until we do away with tax havens, not that some small island can't have a bank and have customers, but Grand Cayman, for example, the Cayman Islands, is a place with 45,000 people. It has 600 banks, and it is the fifth largest financial system in the world, with something like $500 billion listed on account. Of course, it's not as if there's cash actually buried in a vault there. We're talking about paper money, but what it means is that records of wherever the money, whatever it really is, because the way the banking system works, it works by compensation, and banks have paper value. Those $500 billion are in Grand Cayman because they can be kept secret, and the owners of that money cannot be called to account. Until we destroy that possibility, until we end bank secrecy, we will not be able to stop these nefarious dealings.
But, you know, recent discussions of bank secrecy have focused on the very real fact that terrorists use these networks to move money back and forth. And yet, a lot of the outcry against breaking that secrecy has come from powerful corporate interests who said, oh, we can't do this. It'll interrupt the way of doing business, which is an interesting...
Well, that way of doing business, they're talking about two things. They're talking about international bribery, and they're talking about tax evasion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it would interrupt the way of doing business, but we ought to interrupt that way of doing business.
Amen. Amen. Absolutely. Lucy, we have been talking about the BCCI, and specifically we've been talking about a book that features a chapter by you in that. I wonder, once again, we've talked about it before, but please tell us about the book, encapsulate some of the other information, and above all, tell us how people can get it, and tell us about your website.
The book is called A Game as Old as Empire. It's the follow-on to Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which was written by John Perkins. It's edited by Stephen Hyatt. It's published by Barrett Kohler, and it has a dozen chapters. Mine is BCCI's Double Game, Banking on America, Banking on Jihad. Other chapters are Dirty Money, Inside the Secret World of Offshore Banking, or Mercenaries on the Front Lines in the New Scramble for Africa, or Global Empire, The Web of Control. It looks at the money game, really, I would say, is the money and the corporate game, the international corporate game. Those are the central elements of this, and it talks specifically about how they play out all over the world to the detriment of most of us in the world. You can get it on my website at a one-third discount. My website is thecommissarscoop.com, commissar spelled with a K, K-O-M-I-S-A-R, thecommissarscoop.com. And on the front page, you'll see a link which will take you to Amazon where you can get the book and have it sent to you.
And there will be links for these things to Lucy's website in the written description for this program that will eventually be up at www.spitfirelist.com. One last comment I'll make, Lucy, is that if some of this seems confusing to listeners who are trying to wrap themselves around all of these many names and individuals and relationships, it is supposed to be confusing. It's not supposed to be transparent. It's supposed to be opaque. But thanks to your efforts and the efforts of others, some of it at least is becoming clear. We have been visiting with Lucy Commissar, an expert on offshore and the author of a chapter in a book about the BCCI, the forthcoming A Game as Old as Empire by Barrett Kohler, published by Barrett Kohler. For Lucy Commissar, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Sod 2 of For the Record program number 589, interview with Lucy Commissar about the BCCI. This is where it's being recorded on March 11th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. For Lucy Commissar, thanks for listening.